Hello, friends. It's the Environment Show, and welcome. While time is running out for Northeast states to decide whether to keep contracts with Hydro-Québec in Canada, the deals would buy thousands of megawatts of electricity from huge hydro projects at James Bay. Activists hoping to block the deals take to the road, ban the dam, the bicycle tour, this time on the Environment Show. Also, the answer to our energy questions may be blowing in the wind. We'll be visiting a wind generator on Vermont's Mount Equinox this time on the Environment Show. We hope you'll stay tuned. The Environment Show is a national production made possible by the J.M. Kaplan Fund of New York. And this is Bruce Robertson. Below the summit of Mount Equinox in the Green Mountains of western Vermont, Green Mountain Power, the regional utility company, operates two wind generators. In a light summer breeze, the blades turn gently, scooping the air with their three-fingered blades. As the breeze rises and falls, the blades either rotate or slow to a stop. The summit of Mount Equinox rises nearly 4,000 feet above sea level. At 3,300 feet, on a lower ridge, the two generators are mounted on 80-foot towers about 200 yards apart. The only other structure on the ridge is a small hut. John Zimmerman, an energy consultant and designer of wind generators, sited and erected these machines. As we talked, the breeze picked up again and the rotors slowly began to spin.
See, it'll feather its blades and then it goes into a holding pattern to see if there's enough wind to make them go. And if there is, it'll bring them into full power pitch. And if there's not, it'll sort of give up right.
What is the technology that allows it to sense not only the direction but the intensity, whether there is enough wind to go into full generation?
Well, the direction, it's a downwind machine, and that is there's no mechanical drives to keep the machine pointed into wind. It's the wind blowing itself that keeps it pointed down. As far as knowing if there is enough wind or not, it just actually looks at the power coming off the generator. And if there's no power coming off the generator, it interprets that usually correctly as being there's not enough wind to go, and it will shut itself down.
So it's a loop that as it's being generated, it's sensing, it sends a sensor signal back to the generator that there is power being generated.
Yeah, both turbines are controlled by a computer that's in the building in between them down there. And the computer is constantly monitoring operational parameters at the machines and actually tells them what to do. So the brains aren't really here at all. The brains are down there that are running the machine.
Okay, let's get some specs on this. Speaking of brains and specs and the like, let's get some specs on this. The tower is how tall?
Well, these are on 80-foot towers. They're 100 kilowatts each. The blade diameter is 56 feet. When they're running, the tip speed is approximately 150 miles an hour, and they're rotating at a speed of 72 RPM. You can hear that one. See, it looks like you brought it into full power pitch.
Yeah. Now, it has the capacity to sense that there is too much wind and feather itself and shut itself down, right?
Yeah, it's essentially the same process that it looks at to shut itself down if there's not enough wind, except it just looks if there's too much power coming off the generator, which would cause it damage, it'll trigger it, it'll feather the blades and stop. There's no mechanical brake on there. It's all the aerodynamic braking caused by the feathering of the blade. So that's why you see this one here is shut off. It's still slowly rotating around.
One of the criticisms, John, of wind generation as a potential source is that you need at least a steady source and a steady enough at a certain miles per hour. But in fact, how weak or small of a wind can you take and still turn these blades? I mean, it's just sort of a breeze at the summit here, and we've got the blades are turning. It's not a howling gale here.
Right. Well, they will start turning in about 14 miles per hour, which it feels like we're in about a 14 mile per hour right now. But they won't be producing much power. Even though the generator is rated at 100 kilowatts, I would guess right now in a 14 mile per hour wind or 15 mile per hour wind, it might be producing only 10 kilowatts, only one-tenth of its potential, because the winds are light. If the winds were to pick up, the power going through the rotor increases, of course, and more power will come out to generate.
So what is the potential top miles per hour, or what is this set at to shut down? How fast could the winds be blowing?
Well, the machines start, as I said, around 14. They'll keep increasing their power up to about 29 miles per hour. And then from 29 miles per hour to 45, they'll generate their top output. Over 45, they shut off.
What do we know about the wind speed and the duration on this summit year-round on an average annual basis each day? Or, you know, what I'm saying is that how many days would there be peak power being produced?
Yeah. Well, the interesting thing about not only this site, but all the sites available here in Vermont to a Vermont utility, is that the winds blow the hardest in the winter months. And that's when the power up here is the most valuable, because we peak in the winter months. That correlation is very attractive, to have your power coming when you need the power. Even though wind's intermittent, it's off some of the time, it's on some of the time, it'll give you twice the energy in January, at least, than you'll get in July.
John Zimmerman, wind generator designer and consultant, he says there is potential to generate up to 50 megawatts of power in Vermont from wind generation. To achieve this would need 5 or 6 locations with 30 of these generators at each site. There are many questions concerning performance of the generators. Designed for use in dry California mountain climates, the chief concern is how they will perform in winter conditions in New England. Perhaps we will never rely on wind for all of our power, but according to the U.S. Department of Energy, we have the potential to generate billions of kilowatts of electricity, enough to displace 870 billion barrels of oil. This is Bruce Robertson. It is mid-morning, and the sun is already hot and high in the summer sky. The song of the cicadas buzz in the trees along the creek. In a field opposite the firehouse on the Onondaga Reservation, just south of Syracuse, New York, 30 members of the James Bay and Northern Wilderness Task Force from all around the nation are joined by a delegation of visiting Canadian Cree and other supporters. The task force will take a message of warning to towns across New York and New England, traveling not by horse, as Paul Revere, but by all manner of bicycles. Having spent the night camping at a nearby state park, the riders are eager and full of energy. From North Carolina, Wendy Tonker, education director of the task force, gathers the group in a circle.
I just want to thank everybody for coming out today. And we're going to launch a 12-week bike tour right now that's going to educate the people of New York to cancel the contracts with Hydro-Québec so that the village of Great Whale and many others aren't destroyed. Mariah Kwapit's going to give us a blessing in Cree. And all the bikers be safe, and we'll see you at Columbus Circle.
Amen.
Band the dam, you guys. Be careful.
Take a stand.
The tour is to begin with a ride down Highway 11 into downtown Syracuse, where a noontime rally is planned at Columbus Circle. Everyone is laughing and cheering and nervously waiting to get going. Water bottles are filled, tire pressures checked, and helmets adjusted. Local television film crews provide some excitement and delay as various members of the task force take a moment to interview. The bicyclists stretch back along the reservation road. Shouts go up to get going.
Everybody ready?
It is shortly before 11, and the first Ban the Dam bicycle tour is now underway. The dam in question is the Great Whale, the second phase of a project being proposed by the Quebec provincial utility Hydro-Québec. The company wants to build a series of dams across major tributary rivers to James Bay, including the Great Whale River, creating one of the largest construction projects in the world. The result would flood an area equal to the size of France and affect a watershed comparable to the United States east of the Mississippi. The reservoirs would create a hydroelectric generating system capable of providing enough power to sell to the United States. Work on the Great Whale system has not yet begun, in part the result of court delays over procedures for an environmental review of the impacts of such a system. Recently, the Canadian Federal Court of Appeal threw out a National Energy Board requirement that Hydro-Québec conduct a full environmental impact study before beginning construction. Hydro-Québec had said it already completed a full EIS according to provincial requirements. The appeal court ruling agrees and thus clears the way for construction to begin. However, immediately following the court ruling recently, the Canadian federal government announced that it would conduct an EIS of its own. The announcement by Environment Minister Jean Charest was greeted by opponents as the good news following what was seen as the previous bad news from the appeal court. It is not clear, though, whether Hydro-Québec will wait for the federal review or begin construction immediately. In any event, the federal review is said to be non-binding. Though defenders of the project in the United States point out this is not a matter for U.S. intervention, opponents point out that New York State alone will be spending nearly $20 billion over the course of a contract to buy electricity they claim is not even needed. The road turns into a long, slow hill shortly after the start of the expedition. With my recording equipment slung over my shoulder, I pull up to the front of the pack on my bicycle to have a word with Aiken Tompkins, associate director of the task force. I have been wondering why the group would travel by bicycle.
Because it's the closest, best way to get to the most people directly. We're going to be on the ground, going town to town, and we're going to be telling everybody we come into contact with everything we can about James Bay so that this kind of tragedy doesn't happen now and never happens again.
What do you expect the reaction as you go through these towns on a bicycle with a message?
I imagine most will be receptive. I'm sure we'll have some suspicious encounters, but all in all, I think that the shock value of seeing this many people on a bicycle for the same reason will probably do our work for us. And I think everybody's going to be curious, and I imagine that most people will be quite receptive. And we plan to talk to everybody, the ones that are and are not receptive, because we feel feel like everybody has a right to know what we're doing here and have a right to ask us all the questions they possibly can about it. And we better be prepared to answer them, no matter from what angle they come from.
Let me ask you, Aiken, you got a set kind of a short 2 or 3 minute explanation for the person who says, who are you and what are you talking about? I've never heard of this.
Yes, we are a grassroots campaign made up of just ordinary people whose object it is to educate people in the Northeast, provide information for them about the James Bay 2 project, which is the largest construction project in the Western Hemisphere, which stands to destroy vast acres of land and displace approximately 15,000 native people from their homes. And we feel that if people knew about this, that they wouldn't stand for it, because history tells us that this is the pattern for our civilization, and it's got to stop. It's a negative pattern, a destructive pattern. And we feel if people knew the nature of this development and the nature of the people that were trying to pull it off, that they would insist that it be halted at all costs, and we're out there to provide the information that would lead to that end.
It is difficult to talk and climb the hill. We fall silent and gear down to make the crest. The others follow. The reservation road soon turns onto the main South Highway leading into Syracuse. The traffic is heavier. Talk is less frequent and more sparing. As we approach the outskirts of the city, we are met by a police cruiser for an escort, the officer waving us on through busy intersections, his roof lights flashing. The group feels proud and exhilarated to be welcomed and guided so. People on the sidewalk cheer and offer words of encouragement. A few young people out for a morning ride join in and take a place in the pack. Highway 11 becomes Salina Street, now heavy with late morning traffic. Sweeping into town on Salina Street, we turn right on Johnson, leading to Columbus Circle, the heart of downtown Syracuse. A delegation from the task force has gone ahead to set up a PA system, exhibits, and posters. The rally is set to start at 12 noon. Many look at their watches, about 10 minutes, right on schedule. Dean Swagey, an attorney specializing in Native American affairs in Washington, D.C., has arrived. He takes the opportunity to explain how this hydro project is really a violation of international standards for human rights, and the Quebec provincial government is just charging ahead to build it, he says.
Essentially, what we've got is there's a few people in the government of Quebec who have a vision of economic development through industrialization, and they're willing to destroy the Cree people of Quebec in order to achieve their vision.
What's the legal maneuvers and legal leverage that the Cree and the Inuit would have to block this?
Well, I'm not that familiar with Canadian law. The Cree have been fighting it in several avenues, and both in lawsuits in the provincial courts and in the federal courts. In terms of the international human rights, there are standards which anyone who objectively looks at the project can conclude would be violated, but there aren't any enforcement mechanisms to protect the human rights of indigenous peoples.
The task force has been working both here in the United States and in Canada on behalf of the Cree and Inuit. The cathedral bells at noon begin to toll the hour as Mariah Quapet, a Cree on her first visit to the United States, tells of the disaster her people expect if the project goes through.
This would flood most of the lands in our community, our hunting grounds, and you know, they would be tearing up the environment around the community.
You feel scared or angry or both?
Well, I guess both in a way. This would be angry towards the breaking of the environment, and the way we used to hunt would be disrupted, and this makes us people angry. But when I say scared is when the road comes through to our community, it will cause a lot of problems or create problems for the people, like alcohol and drugs into the community.
What do you want to tell the people of the United States about what is happening up there?
Well, I guess I just to get them to know that what is happening there is disrupting our lives, and you know, their support right now is great, and it is very helpful for the Cree. I really like it here. It's our first time, and I met a lot of people already, and they're really good at supporting us.
Shortly after the rally begins, Quapit is called to the microphone to address the crowd. The wind is calm, the sun shimmering on the cobblestones of the square. The crowd shifts. Somebody whispers in observation. The huge fountain and pool in the center of the square are empty and dry. Is this a sign? Quapit is nervous but determined as she tells how the death of caribou and fish in the flood will affect an ecosystem much larger than her homeland and people.
The struggle against the James Bay Project, therefore, should not only be a struggle by the Crees and Inuit of Quebec, but a struggle by all of us on this planet. Let us, therefore, join hands in this fight, because it is only with our solidarity, no matter what color of skin we have, but we can let others see that this important struggle means the fight for the survival of mankind on this planet. Thank you, and you on the bikes have a nice and safe trip. We will meet you on many of your stops on this journey. Thank you.
As the next speakers take the mic, a patrol officer on foot approaches the rear of the rally and orders the vehicles parked on the square be moved. Some in the crowd turn their attention. The sun is hot. The riders are eager to get started. The vehicles in question are moved, but the rally is near the end. Singer-songwriter Harvey Nussbaum gets up to sing his message. He hasn't got a song specifically about James Bay, he says, but the situation brought to mind an old folk song. Leadbelly or Woody Guthrie would have sung this one here today.
And pity the miners digging my bones, where it's dark as a dungeon, damp as the tomb. Danger is double and the pleasures are few, where the rain never falls and the sun never shines. It's dark as a dungeon way down in the mine.
The bicyclists soon left, and the rally officially came to an end. It's hard to gauge the success. Many of the onlookers gathered, no doubt, because it was something going on at noon. A war protest or something, they thought. Instead, they saw what the British garrison must have seen at Bunker Hill, a rabble in arms. This peaceful bicycle tour will be cycling through towns and cities, urging the cancellation of a series of contracts signed between the state governments here in the United States and Hydro-Québec. Meanwhile, government officials and utility representatives in Quebec insist the project will go through and will cause minimal disruption and maximum benefit. This is Bruce Robertson.
And the pleasures are few, where the rain never falls and the sun never shines. It's dark as a dungeon way down in the mine.
Well, that's our show for this week. We hope you enjoyed this edition of The Environment Show. The Environment Show is a program about the environment, the air, water, soil, wildlife, and people of our common habitat. If you know of something happening in your area that you think we ought to know about, or if you have a question about this week's or any week's Environment Show, feel free to drop us a line. Address your questions and comments to The Environment Show, 318 Central Avenue, Albany, New York, 12206. For a cassette copy of this program, call 1-800-767-1929. That's 1-800-767-1929. Ask for The Environment Show number 81. The Environment Show is a presentation of National Productions, which is solely responsible for its contents. Dr. Alan Shartok is executive producer, and this is Bruce Robertson. The Environment Show is made possible by the J.M. Kaplan Fund of New York.